Welcome to another episode of Living Downstream. This weekend's episode focuses on fish and aquatic habitat in and around the Umpqua watershed. You'll hear from Jeff McEnroe and Jeff Dose, current and former fish biologists in the region. Before we jump into the interviews, I want to do a land acknowledgement to recognize the Indigenous groups who historically occupied the land upon which our watershed and county are located. These groups include the Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Malala, and others. Jeffrey J. Dose was a professional fish biologist and worked as the senior fish and aquatic biologist for the Umpqua National Forest before his retirement in 2011. He served on the scientific panel on late successional forests of the Pacific Northwest, an aquatic team which developed management recommendations for the U.S. Congress, and he also assisted in the development of the Northwest Forest Plan. He has actively participated in the American Fisheries Society and written for several scientific journals. We're excited to have him on today's episode. Jeff, tell us a little about your work. What does a fisheries biologist do?
Well, it's actually a pretty broad profession. Some of it is totally biology, but in my realm, it actually was probably more closely related to ecology and hydrology and geology and how that all comes together to eventually lead to a biologic outcome. And so some fisheries biologists just deal with fish. In my work, I worked with more habitat and water quality and ecosystem health and protection than I did with the fish themselves, although I work with them as well.
That's interesting. Yeah, I wasn't really sure. I heard that you were a fisheries biologist, and I wasn't sure myself what you did. And I don't have that much knowledge about fish. You know, that wasn't really my background coming in. So I'm eager to learn more. And thank you for sharing a little bit about your background. What first sparked your interest? Like, what made you want to go into the field of fisheries biology?
I grew up in Coos Bay and Eugene, with a family that were heavily into hunting and fishing and the outdoors. And I mean, at age three, I am told I caught my first salmon. I don't even remember it, but my dad and my mom both told me that, yeah, you caught one at age three. So early history. After high school, Vietnam War was going on, and I enlisted in the Navy and was a hospital corpsman, worked with the Marines and the Navy. And after the Vietnam War ended, I got out, and I was kind of at a loss as to what to do next. I had had a fair amount of medical training and probably could have done okay in med school or, you know, some related, RN or some other related field. But after contemplation, someone asked me one time, what do you really want to do? And I said, you know, I really want to be outdoors. I really want to be part of understanding what's going on in the world. And being an Oregonian, rivers and streams and fish were something that just drew me. So that's why I majored in fishery science.
Yeah, it's always nice when people ask, what do you want to do? You know, I feel like that question is so valuable. And I think if people were asked that or thought about that, you know, contemplated their answer, maybe younger in life, it might benefit them. Because really thinking about what we want to do and then going into something that we love, like spending time outdoors, like you said. Yeah, I was a teacher for a number of years and I wholeheartedly value education and I want to continue doing something relating to education. But I too was thinking, man, I really want to be outside. I want to do more with like the environment and maybe environmental education. So that's why I actually switched and, you know, I'm doing AmeriCorps and I'm really grateful for this opportunity. But yeah, trying to get into kind of a more environmental field. There's such value in spending time outside. I was thinking about what you said about catching the fish when you were so young. I vaguely remember the first time I caught a fish and then I realized that was going to be dinner and I didn't eat fish again for quite a while.
Yeah, that never bothered me.
Yeah, I don't know. It was a little tough for me. I don't know how old I was. I don't think I was three, but.
Yeah, you know what? After I graduated from Oregon State with both the degree in fisheries, my first job was actually in Montana, eastern Montana, out in the prairie. And that was a completely different world from what I grew up in and what I was expecting. And the climate was very, very different. I showed up in Malta, Montana, in late December, and it was minus 40 degrees. And growing up in Western Oregon, you know, anything, you know, that was below freezing was cold. Minus 40 is really cold, let me tell you. I stayed there a couple of years, working on a environmental impact statement for the Bureau of Land Management, completed that and wanted to get back to Oregon quickly, and was offered a job in Medford. And in 1980, we moved to Medford. My family, by then I was married and we had a young son. And I was in Medford with the BLM working in primarily the Umpqua, but also the Rogue River Basin. In 1987, I took a job with the Umpqua National Forest as the program lead for the fisheries program and been here ever since. I've been in Roseburg since 1987.
Wow. Yeah. I know what you mean about the difference in climate. I'm from the Northeast and right now they're kind of getting pummeled with snow. And here for me is the very different place to go outside. You know, I was sitting outside this morning and working on something and I wouldn't be able to really do that back home. So I'm wondering what species of fish, you said you didn't necessarily always work with directly with fish, but more ecology and how, you know, animals and organisms interact. What species of fish are native to the Umpqua watershed and how are they doing?
Native fishes, they're actually the Umpqua Basin has quite a diversity of native species for what I call the West Slope of the Cascades. The Rogue and the Umpqua are the only two river systems that have their headwaters at the crest of the Cascades and go all the way to the ocean without flowing into the Columbia or some of the river system. And that has led to some speciation. The Umpqua has three indigenous minnows, cyprinids, fishes that are found nowhere else, which is kind of unique. And that means that the river system has been isolated for a long time for evolution to occur. Those are Umpqua chub, Umpqua dace, and Umpqua pike minnow. I know most people are more interested in the sexier species, the salmon and the steelhead and the southers, but the rest of these species are also pretty important part of how the whole system works. And group of organisms that are native to our river are the sturgeons. Another one that most people don't think about, except for a few people who fish for them. We have two species of sturgeon in the Umpqua. The white sturgeon is by far the most common. They're anadromous. They go to the ocean. They come back. They travel a long ways. They're long-lived. They live 80 to 100 years. They have no bones. They're ancient. They're an ancient fish. Their entire skeleton is cartilage. And the other species is green sturgeon. They are not doing well at all. I think they're probably have been proposed, if not listed, as an endangered species. They're just not very common. Now we'll get to the sexy ones. We have several anadromous, that means spawn and rear in freshwater, go to the ocean, spend a certain amount of time in the ocean and then come back and spawn. And the salmon species that we have in this river are Chinook salmon, two races, a spring run and a fall run, different life histories, not a whole lot of interaction between the two. We also have coho salmon, which are listed as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. The Umpqua should be a place where recovery of those that species could occur, should occur, because historically they were abundant here. And the other one is steelhead, which is actually a rainbow trout that goes to the ocean. Their life history is, again, variable. They spend up to 3 years, usually 2 years, as juveniles living in freshwater in our rivers and streams. Then they go to the ocean. They spend 1, 2, even 3 years, sometimes 4 years in the ocean, and then come back and spawn. Unlike Chinook and Coho, which die after spawning, steelhead do not necessarily die. They are capable of going back to the ocean and doing a return spawning. As terms of the abundance, as I said, Coho are listed as a threatened species under the Federal Endangered Species Act. So they're not doing as well as they should. Spring Chinook, we have really two populations, and they're very distinct. One is in the North Umpqua. It's relatively healthy, not historically abundant, but they're not threatened, let's put it that way. There's also a population, very, very small population, in the South Umpqua. Two very different river systems. I probably should have gotten into that beforehand, but the Spring Chinook and the South Umpqua are right on the edge of extinction. And we know from historical records from the 1930s that summer steelhead were abundant, or common anyway, in the South Umpqua. They are now extinct in the South Umpqua. Our winter steelhead population in the North Umpqua is doing quite well. Summer steelhead population is entirely in the North Umpqua, has a large hatchery component, and seems to be declining for a number of reasons. And anytime you have an organism that moves thousands of miles during the course of its life, there are factors anywhere along that continuum that can affect their ability to survive and their abundance. And the ocean plays a big role for these fish that are in nets. Okay, those are pretty much the native species. We also have a lot of introduced non-native species. And the big one, actually the most abundant fish in the main Umpqua and the South Umpqua rivers, are smallmouth bass, which are not native to Oregon at all. They were introduced, we think, probably in the 1960s or 70s. I've read in DeKalb Creek, and they spread throughout. They are doing extremely well. As I said, they're the most abundant fish. Unfortunately, not only are they abundant and doing well in our systems, they are also voracious predators. And one of their, they'll eat just about anything they can catch. And unfortunately, our juvenile salmon and steelhead that head downstream heading for the ocean are subject to being preyed upon by smallmouth bass. Other introduced species, we have striped bass in the Umpqua, which are from the East Coast of North America. We also have American shad, which are also from the East Coast, that were introduced into the San Francisco Bay Area in the late 1800s, and have distributed themselves in suitable habitats. And the Umpqua is very suitable, and we have an abundant run, actually, of shad. I'm not sure what ecological impact they're having. It's not as apparent as what the smallmouth bass are doing, but the fact that there are probably millions of juvenile shad every year is having some impact.
You're listening to an episode of Living Downstream on KQUA, brought to you by Umpqua Watersheds. Yeah, it's pretty incredible to think about some fish going from freshwater rivers to the ocean, which is saltwater, and then back and being able to survive. I don't know. It's not something I'm super familiar with from back home. So hearing about that, I think someone mentioned that in a previous interview that I conducted as well. That's really neat that I've heard of, other migratory animals, like, certain butterflies or birds or something, but yeah, to think about fish and certain aquatic species traveling so far, and like you said, potentially meeting disaster along the way or different threats, anywhere along the path. It's just crazy to think about.
It really is. And I think one thing that has always struck me is the unique evolutionary adaption that anadromous fishes have, in that they spawn and rear in relatively safe freshwater environments, when they go down to the ocean, they have to completely change their whole physiology in order to go from fresh water to salt water. And they go to salt water and they do their thing. They go somewhere. They go to the North Pacific. Some of them go to off of California. They go various places, spend years, and then come back. And again, their kidney has to change from a saltwater kidney to a freshwater kidney. Dramatic change. And there are not that many organisms that have been able to do that. And this happened somewhere around 40 million years ago, plus or minus. Our current species, we think, have been around for about 8 million years. So, they've survived all that time, not always in the same place. During ice ages, the center of the salmon and steelhead world was probably someplace like Baja California in Mexico. You know, some of the rivers and streams in Southern California and in Mexico was probably because the rest of it was all covered with ice. So, and they managed, they do have a straying capability and they can recolonize places. They've been doing it for a long time.
Yeah, and to think that some of these species are, you know, threatened, endangered, or going extinct now. Yeah, have you noticed specific changes in the past, you know, 30 or 40 years or however long you've been doing fisheries work in this area? I don't know, just like certain things that you've noticed, or, you know, be human impacts or different things that have happened that you can pinpoint and say like, whoa, like that used to be different.
Yes, I have noticed some observational things. And wrote a chapter in a book that was published by the American Fisheries Society dealing with that issue. And the changes that humans have made to our aquatic systems, our rivers and streams, from the ridgetops all the way to the ocean, have been very dramatic. And they started big time after World War II. When our economy and our population and our wealth as a country blossomed. And once that started and there became a need for more economic and social growth like such as that for people, that had a profound effect on what's going on with our rivers and streams. And it involves everything from irrigation, taking water out of our rivers and streams for agriculture. It involves same thing for hydropower, dams, same thing for residential uses. You get a big city and you got a bunch of people, they're going to take water. They're going to get it from somewhere. And they're taking it from, obviously, our natural rivers and streams. But my observation in Southwest Oregon over the last 50 years, really, has been that the biggest factor that has impacted the freshwater part of the ecosystem for our salmon and steelhead is the timber industry. Clear cutting and road construction has dramatically impacted our rivers and streams and their functionality and the ecology of those rivers and streams. And it continues to this day. If anything, it's getting worse. I know that what we had this last year with wildfires were catastrophic, and they were, particularly to people. You know, if you live there or were impacted by any of that, it was catastrophic to you. From an ecological perspective, it's not. It's part of the natural disturbance. It happens routinely every 100 to 300 to 500 years. It's happened before. It'll happen again. The biggest impact was to human infrastructure, not so much to the ecology of the land and the water. Huge fires in late 1980s in Yellowstone demonstrated that. It was wilderness. It was a national park. It burned like crazy and was monitored very carefully afterwards. And what they found was that fish populations in the rivers and streams that were a part of that fire declined for about 3 to 5 years and then rebounded. And within 10 years, they were at or above the previous abundance. So nature is capable of responding to natural disturbances. What they can't respond to is unnatural disturbances, which is what humans do. I've heard it described before is that natural disturbances are large in scale, but very infrequent, whereas human disturbances are relatively small in scale, but continuous, as opposed to infrequent. And I think that's the biggest difference.
Yeah, that's a good distinction to make. Yeah, because it seems like people kind of keep doing things, you know? And one thing I've been thinking about in terms of living in timber country, you know, that's kind of how I've heard of it described. You know, there's cutting of trees back home, you know, where I'm from, but the amount of clear cutting that I've seen here is so different. And I just feel that, and I, you know, have been reading articles about, you know, when we cut down a whole forest and then replant, you know, a swath of all the same type of tree, you're not replanting a forest, you're just replanting monoculture of the same type of tree. So you mentioned earlier thinking about, you know, kind of the landscape and the ecosystem as a system, you know, as this community, this interconnected web, as opposed to, you know, just all of the same.
I concur with you. I mean, what is being practiced certainly on almost all private forest lands and somewhat on public forest lands is essentially agriculture. It's not ecosystem management. It's not even forest management. It's agriculture. They're growing a crop. It takes 30 or 40 years to get that crop instead of every year like with corn. But it's the same notion. And that's why they put fertilizer on it. That, you know, I mean, all the infrastructure it takes to develop and harvest and remove it is all completely unnatural disturbance. And there's a paper out that I read here recently from a professor at Oregon State University that suggested that the timber industry is the largest single source of carbon dioxide from the state of Oregon into our atmosphere. There are several other papers that have recently concluded that turning an old growth forest into a plantation of, you know, monoculture, single age species, reduces water yield from that part of the watershed for at least 50 years, at least 50 years. And this is based on high quality research based on experimental watersheds that were established over 50 years ago. And they've been continued ever since. Credit to the Forest Service. They're the ones that developed them. They're the ones that have kept them going. There's a huge difference really in the management philosophy. And it wasn't always different, but after the Northwest Forest Plan, it changed big time for the Forest Service versus private.
Yeah, kind of thinking that on the flip side of that, of, you know, some of the things that have been done and the negative changes that are, you know, harming the ecosystem, what could be done? You know, what changes could be made, or what are some recommendations you would make moving forward?
Well, if I was king for a day, I think that speaking from a fisheries guy and a watershed guy, that the aquatic conservation strategy from the Northwest Forest Plan could and should be implemented across all land ownership patterns. And there were a number of objectives, and they were based on natural disturbance regimes. And it had to do with sediment regimes, it had to do with water quality, it had to do with flow regimes, the hydrology of our rivers and streams. In my view, and I was part of it, so I'm biased, but it really was an elegant way of describing what needs to happen in our forested areas, at least in Oregon, Western Oregon, Washington, Northern California. If you want to research that, it's available. But I mean, what precipitated this was spotted owls, you know, a terrestrial species.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about how interconnected species are too. You know, I read a couple articles about wolves in Yellowstone, and, you know, then it led to certain plants coming back because, you know, the moose or the elk or something, those weren't eating those same plants right by the river. And just, you know, so many things are connected. So, you know, we started out talking about water and fish, and now we're talking about the spotted owl, which, like you said, is a terrestrial animal. So just thinking about, man, there's so many connections that you know, we understand and know some of them, but there are a lot that we still don't know. And, you know, as we change one part of that system, then something else changes and we realize later, oh, that was connected. You know, we didn't realize that connection.
I think you're correct. And to try to focus on a species or even a group of species is the wrong approach. What you need to think about is how it all connects. The spotted owl was sort of a harbinger of what was going on in forests in Western Oregon and Washington, Northern California. But that affected the streams, the water quality, the fish, the prey species, basically everything. And you hit on it earlier, and one of my favorite sayings is always tell everybody, always remember, gravity works. In other words, what goes on up here eventually ends up down there, and it's rarely better.
Yeah.
But the aquatic conservation strategy of the Northwest Forest Plan, to me, is still a pretty good model that could be used elsewhere. It would be rejected by the private industry, I can tell you that, but they fought it tooth and nail when the U.S. government adopted it.
Why do you think there is that pushback?
Economics. You know, when you start dealing with natural resource management, you have to consider economic, social, political, and maybe biological or ecological. You know, there are at least four big things, and three of them have nothing to do with natural functioning of an ecosystem. They have to do with what people desire.
Yeah, I feel like, I don't know, if people really think long term, you know, what would be economically viable or sustainable could also or would also be environmentally sustainable. You know, if we try to take all the resources from a certain place, at some point you're going to run out, you know, like, like we said, even if you're planting that monoculture, single crop, you know, single species, you know, bunch of trees, as opposed to replenishing the forest or letting the forest come back naturally, then you've just wiped that, you know, stand of trees out again. You still don't have the forest. So eventually you're just going to run out. You know, the soil can't handle it. The earth can't handle it. So if we think more long-term and more sustainably, both economically and environmentally, I feel like, I don't know. Yeah, I recently heard somebody said that it shouldn't be that, you know, the timber industry or corporations it shouldn't be that they're at odds with environmentalists. You know, everyone wants clean air to breathe, clean water to drink. Almost everyone, I would think, enjoys spending, you know, time going for a walk in nature. But we shouldn't be opposed to greed. You know, we should be opposed to practices that are harmful for everyone. And yet we aren't, you know, some people are not. And they go along with plans that ultimately hurt us in the end.
Yeah, I think you kind of hit the crux of the issue is, what are human motivations? What are the strongest human motivations? And how does that play out in the social, political, and economic and ecological realm? And my observations after a number of years is that there is a real dichotomy right now going on. And a lot of it really changed with the Clinton administration, and there's been efforts since then to either push them back or eliminate them if possible, or at least kind of ignore them. The Obama administration had lots of things on its plate. Ecological health really wasn't a biggie for them. I think climate change certainly was on his mind and that administration's mind, but it's looming out there, and it's going to be huge, and it's going to have, I think, very substantial impacts on all of our aquatic resources, and including human uses. There's going to be different hydrology. We're going to have more droughts. We're going to have more floods. We're going to have more extreme weather conditions that are based on the climate. And I think we here in the Pacific Northwest are probably going to be less impacted than many other places. That's kind of what I've read through the literature, but we're going to be impacted too. But other places are going to be impacted even more. Alaska is going to be changed dramatically. Much of South America is going to be changed dramatically. It's probable that some of the warm currents that have made Northern Europe habitable are going to cease, and they're going to be in, almost in an ice age in Norway and Sweden and Denmark and places like that. In Russia, who knows? you know, there are things going on, and there are some things we can do about it, and there are some things we cannot do about it. But to just put aside and decide that, oh, it's going to happen to somebody else is a wrong thinking, in my view.
Yeah, I think that it'd be helpful if people, I don't know, saw the whole of the human population, a worldwide population, as kind of more of a group together, you know? So too often there's these divisions of like, oh, well, I'm going to, you know, just take care of my own. And instead of, okay, like what impact am I having on everyone else too? You know, it's not just about me anymore. It's not just about you. You know, that's the whole idea with this show being called Living Downstream, is that we all have an impact on somebody else. And now we need to start thinking about it, because we're impacting those other people. You know, when we produce plastic, or when we drain too much water, or, you know, I mean, there's so many things. And if we can make these changes, they could help other people. And I think that's important. Yeah, I guess before we go, are there any ways that listeners could get involved with the solution? You know, any either citizen science projects or specific, you know, just changes that either individuals or groups could take?
Oh boy, that's a big one. I would say become active in any number of different non-governmental organizations that are working towards restoration, conservation of our rivers and streams and our forests. I mean, they're all connected. There's a number of local groups. There's a number of statewide and even national groups. Another one that I think has some promise is the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition. I'm involved on one of their committees, and our focus so far has been education. And we've had a number of forums and brought in some wonderful experts, professionals, you know, to talk about various issues, everything from ocean acidification to drought, you know, and everything in between. I would say contact Douglas County Global Warming Coalition and see if you can get involved. And of course, Umpqua Watersheds. I think those kinds of grassroots organizations raise the awareness level of people, probably more so than a lot of the national ones. Not that we're always going to be successful. We're kind of fortunate down here, I think, in Douglas County in some ways. Politically, not so much, but resource-wise, yeah. Yeah, we've got some neat stuff. That's why I stay here.
Well, it's been great to have you on the show today, and I really appreciate all of your insights.
Thank you, Ryan.
And now back to Living Downstream, brought to you by Umpqua Watersheds.
I'm here with Jeff McEnroe, fish biologist with the Bureau of Land Management. Jeff is going to talk with us today about stream restoration in areas impacted by the Archie Creek fire. A question I've been wondering, and I think would be a good place for us to start, how were streams and fish populations impacted by the Archie Creek fire and other fires last fall?
Sure. Well, it's great to be here talking with you. I think one of the things I like to talk to people about the Archie Creek fire is, well, one, the streams were impacted by kind of, you know, industrialized logging and human impacts long before the fire. So the fire just kind of is exacerbating some of those effects. And so we can talk about that in another part if you want, the history of some of the things we did to the streams. But specifically the Archie Creek fire, you know, I've been fighting fires for over 20 years now, and it was one of the most devastating wildfires I've ever been on. It started on September 8th. I actually happened to be out in the field that day. And so I watched the Archie Creek fire burn from a ridge, and it was some of the most extreme fire behavior I've ever seen. And so it burned almost 100,000 acres in less than 24 hours. And so the results of that were, you know, usually on a fire, we'll see what we call a mosaic burn. So you have patches that were burned kind of severely and other patches where it just burned the understory and most of the trees are still left. You know, you have kind of this patchwork burn. Well, the way the Archie Creek fire burned, it just consumed everything in its path that first 24 hours. And so we see these crazy effects of like 98 to 100% mortality in the trees in like 100 square mile area. And so like these streams, you know, usually the riparian areas, you know, they, you know, because there's a kind of higher moisture content next to the stream, usually those don't burn too heavily. Well, you know, some of these streams, they lost almost 100% of their riparian shade. And so just some of the effects I think we can expect. Some of this, you know, this fire is kind of unprecedented in its, you know, scope and scale and severity. And so there's a lot of things that are unknown. But typically post-fire, what we see is we'll see, you know, you're losing the root mass of the trees that have died. And so you see increased landslides and mass wasting. So we'll get many more landslides in the next 3 to 5 years in the fire area. We have a lot of trees that have died from the fire. And so you're going to get a lot more trees falling into, you know, streams and roads and all that kind of stuff. And then because of that loss of the riparian shade in such a big area, we're obviously going to see some increased stream temperatures until some of that riparian vegetation recovers. And then with that increased sunlight to the streams, we also get increased primary production in the streams, which, in, you know, equals increased kind of algal growth, and we'll get a lot more kind of aquatic plants growing in the stream, which can be good or bad, depending on how much is there and how quickly it dies off and things like that. So, you know, basically everybody's concerned about the fish, and probably what we're going to see is a decrease in the fish populations over the next 3 to 5 years. The good news is that, you know, these fish have adapted to disturbance, you know, and this was a very big disturbance event, you know, probably a once in centuries disturbance event based on the number of old growth trees that burned up in it. But they have adapted with, you know, disturbance events, you know, whether it's volcanoes or fires or whatever in history. And so they actually respond really well post-disturbance. You know, they get decreased for that first kind of period, 3 to 5 years. But then we'll probably see an increase in fish populations post-disturbance, just because there'll be more sun hitting the stream, more food. So yeah, hopefully we'll see some increased fish populations kind of in the not too far future.
Thank you. Yeah, I feel like it's kind of a more complex issue. And I jotted down a few questions as you were talking. One of which was, you mentioned that usually there's more of a mosaic burn, but this one was different. What made this fire so different?
You know, really what it was, well, we had a lot of dry weather leading into the fire, but really what made this fire different from any other fire was that the weather that was predicted was once or twice every century is what the weather folks were telling us, of this very dry, very heavy east wind. So California gets that a lot. That's why you see some of those devastating fires in California, but Oregon very rarely gets this like dry east wind. And you know, it was up to, you know, 50, 60 miles per hour that day of the fire. And it was, like I said, a very dry wind. When the two fires started, they burned together very quickly and they hit a fire intensity that just was something that we haven't really seen before, you know, with that really heavy east wind. And it threatened communities because of that. Most of our fires start, you know, somewhere at the base of the mountains and burn east into the mountains. And so they rarely threaten, you know, large communities. Whereas this one started in the mountains and it burned west, you know, towards Sutherland, towards Glide. And we don't really see that very often in Oregon.
Yeah, it's crazy how weather and just kind of different climactic issues will come together to cause those big changes. Yeah, I'm just hoping there are not other big fires like that coming again soon. Someone not from this area, that was kind of my introduction to Oregon. And I was like, oh no, I didn't realize there were fires like this. And people here were like, there usually aren't fires like this. So
I would like to say, I'd hope it's a very rare event, but you know, with the way things are changing, it's hard to know what the future is going to entail. And, you know, I think one of the other things that kind of led into this fire was, you know, about a couple of years ago, we had 3 years of pretty extreme drought. And I don't think our forests and our watersheds really ever recovered from that drought. We saw really low, what's called like 100 hour fuel moisture. So these big, heavy logs, the fuel moisture in there was really low. And so that kind of leads to large fire growth when those fuel moistures are really low. And so we never kind of recovered that fuel moisture, if you will, in the forest. And so I think some of the drought led to that extreme fire behavior as well.
Okay. Yeah. I feel like having such drought over time can definitely contribute to just, yeah, there's not as much moisture around. That makes sense. Yeah. So I'm thinking about the streams and fish populations and just some of those different impacts, like you mentioned about, you know, lost riparian shade, having more sunlight in the streams. What type of restoration work needs to be done to remediate an area and help fish or other aquatic organisms after a fire?
Sure. Well, let me just step back a little bit in time because I want your listeners to kind of understand why we would even need to do restoration in the first place. I think that leads into kind of what we can do post-fire to help fish out. And just real briefly, prior to kind of human impacts in the watershed, industrialized logging, homesteading, things like that, you know, in a place like Rock Creek, which is kind of where I'm focusing my efforts, it's kind of the center of the fire. You know, we had huge log jams. We had tons of gravel in the stream, lots of pools, and there was tons of fish and beavers. And the stream was connected with its floodplain. It had side channels in the floodplain. And then humans came in and, you know, we started harvesting a lot of the trees and we cleaned out. We thought the logs in the streams were a bad thing. And so we basically for about 50 years pulled all of the wood out of the streams in the area, in the Umpqua watershed. And then we, you know, I have pictures of bulldozers in Rock Creek, like manipulating the stream and moving it around. And we were not very nice to the streams. And add to that road building and riparian harvest. And there was even a mill up in Rock Creek for, you know, in the 40s and 50s. So we had a mill right there next to the creek. And so we've been very hard on these streams. We've taken out a lot of the key components for them to function properly. And so even prior to the fire, we were planning to do some restoration work in the fire area to help kind of add some of those components back to the stream channel and hopefully get that channel functioning, you know, at a higher level. We may never get back to where they were. You know, some of those impacts, you know, could be permanent or, you know, could take decades to recover from, but trying to get the streams back to kind of a higher functioning level by doing what we call stream restoration. And so kind of specifically within that Archie Creek fire area, Rock Creek watershed is kind of in right in the center of the fire. Over 70% of the watershed was burned with that high tree mortality. And so I feel like it's a great example of kind of what can we do in the fire area. Well, one of the major things I said, you know, the historic practices of stream cleaning was to pull all of the, you know, logs and log jams out of the stream. And so what happened was the stream started down cutting like 4 to 6 feet. It got disconnected with its floodplain. The energy of the stream increased and it kind of blew out all of the gravel that was in the stream. And now we're stuck with these like very large rocks that fish can't spawn in. And so one of the things we're going to do post fire is we're going to utilize these fire killed trees that are in the riparian areas. We're going to push them over with excavators and then we're going to move them into the creek, find the places where log jams were historically, and we're going to build these big log jams that are designed to catch some of that wood and sediment that's going to be and gravel that's going to be moving through the system post-fire. And so this summer, we're working on a contract right now. The BLM's working with the Partnership for the Umpqua Rivers, local watershed council, and we're putting together an over $300,000 contract to get three excavators for 2 months this summer into Rock Creek to build these big log jams that were like the key components There's a lot of other stuff we can do, but that's the highest priority work right now, is to get those logs in there so they can start capturing some of that stuff that's going to be moving through kind of post fires.
Yeah, it's so helpful to understand the history. So thank you for adding that in. I meant to sure. follow back up on that, so I'm glad that you did. Yeah, and I was wondering about the log jams and like why logs are needed, because I was thinking maybe fish habitat, but I didn't even realize or think about how the streams are getting, removing the gravel, moving downward. So I just hadn't even thought about just how a faster stream can impact what's moving through the stream and what's no longer remaining there that's needed by the fish. So yeah, that's a really important point to bring up too.
Yeah, a good way to think about log jams and floodplains for that matter is they're energy dissipators in the stream. And so as you remove that connection with the floodplains and remove those logs, the energy in the stream increases. And so it kind of flushes out any logs that may, you know, get caught up. It flushes out any gravel, and you get down to just these big, large, what we call cobble, you know, large rocks in the stream. And so logs do provide great fish habitat. Juvenile fish love hiding in log jams. Even adult fish like hiding in them. They have many, many functions, but probably the biggest like primary function is to dissipate the energy of the stream and push it out onto its floodplains, which is where the stream wants to be in a flood. The phase one of the restoration work post-fire is adding these big, huge log jams in, right? Well, that's just the first step to try to get these watersheds on a fast track to recovery. So those are going to collect wood and collect substrate and be these big, important process forming features that have been missing from the system. The fire was horrible in, you know, a lot of ways, but one of the benefits of the fire is now we have all the trees we could want to put in the creek, and we have big, huge trees, which is what large streams need to recover. And so one of the side benefits of this horrible fire was that, you know, we have a lot of materials that we can now put in the creek. So the phase two of the project, which is going to happen in, you know, like 2022 and 2023, is what we call floodplain enhancement. And so historically, there was these huge floodplains in Rock Creek, and there was these side channels going through, and side channels are just pure gold for fish. The juvenile fish love them. They thrive in them. They have cover. They have cool water, tons of food. You know, coho and steelhead love to spawn in them. They're just one of the best habitat features for fish. Well, as that stream downcut from those past practices, those side channels stopped getting water. And so what we're going to do is we're going to go back and we're going to actually excavate channels in those historic channels to match kind of where the stream is now. And we call those groundwater channels and pools. And so there was all that water stored up in the floodplain. We're going to excavate down to where that water level is. And so now we will have cool channels and pools in the floodplain for those fish to access, knowing that those stream temperatures are going to come up. We're going to provide what we call cold water refugia for the fish. And so those juvenile fish, as those stream temperatures come up, will have these channels and pools that are, you know, 10 degrees cooler than the main creek that they can dive into and kind of ride out those hot summer months. So pretty excited about that work. We actually haven't really done any of that in the Umpqua Basin. It's been implemented up a lot up north on the Salmon River and places like that. And so pretty excited to watch that and monitor it and see how well it's working.
That sounds great. Yeah, no, it seems like both phases have ways to assist nature with kind of helping restore it, but like getting it so that it can, yeah, do what it needs to do. Are there any ways that the public or like community members could get involved? Like you mentioned partnering with PER, Partnership for the Umpqua River. And, but yeah, are there ways that the public or like community members can get involved either to help, you know, native fish in general or to assist with the BLM's efforts?
You know, there is ways to do it. Unfortunately, you know, some of the big things that we have to do need to be done, you know, with big, heavy equipment and things like that. And so it's tough to kind of get the public involved in that. But one of the main things that we're looking at is with that kind of complete loss of riparian vegetation, one of the quickest ways we can get vegetation back in a burn like that is to plant willows. And so We're going to be working on a project with a number of partners, you know, Native Plant Society. I think Umpqua Watersheds might be involved. Partnership for the Umpqua Rivers, the Steamboaters. We started conversations this spring. We couldn't pull everything together to kind of, you're supposed to plant willows in February-ish. And so it was really tough to get everything pulled together in time to get willow cuttings to plant. But next February or March, we're going to do a pretty big effort to collect a whole bunch of willow cuttings and then hopefully get the public out there, folks that want to volunteer to help, to plant these willow cuttings in the streams, tributaries within the fire area. And those willows are going to do like three things. They're going to help stabilize some of that gravel substrate that starts collecting in the log jams. They kind of help hold onto it with their roots. Willows grow super quickly. And so they're going to provide that like quick shade for the stream while the trees kind of recover. And then willows provide, you know, they provide food for beavers, and beavers can help recovery in a watershed like that really well too. And then they also hopefully will shade out some of the noxious weeds that we know are going to try to get a foothold in a big disturbance area like a fire. And so hopefully those willows are going to really help us with those three things. And I really feel like that's the biggest place that the public can contribute to helping recovery after the fire.
That makes sense. Yeah. And it definitely also makes sense to have, you know, actual like BLM or other, you know, organization people to operate the machinery.
Yeah,
I've heard of willow plantings along, you know, riparian areas. So it's great to hear that there's an effort going to be made in the coming years to, you know, kind of restore those areas. I was thinking back to what you mentioned about like the algae. And I know back east, there have been a lot of problems with algal blooms, like harmful, like toxic algae. So I'm wondering if like anyone is studying that with reduced shade, increased sunlight, and possibly more things washing into the stream because there's not that vegetation. Yeah. Is anyone studying the types of algae? And I guess part B of that question, is the algae like the toxic kind? I don't really know that much about harmful algal blooms, just that they exist.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, honestly, I'm not an expert in that field either, but the Watershed Council actually has Sandy Lyons and Joe Carnes, they're two of their water quality specialists, and they've been studying the algal blooms in the Umpqua Basin for about the last 5 years. And so if you have detailed questions, I'd suggest you get a hold of them. Really, those harmful algal blooms really happen in what we call stagnant water. And so like pools and things like that, that are off the channel, like in the bedrock of the main Umpqua, you know, some of these, what we call stagnant pools, not moving water. We don't usually see the harmful algal blooms in lotic environments or basically streams or rivers, flowing water, but there is a danger with, you know, increased algal blooms. And that is you just get too much primary productivity and it just overwhelms the system. Everything's got to kind of be in balance. And so, you know, a little bit of extra sun in the stream can really stimulate the macro invertebrates or stream bugs that are in the stream. And that's the food for the fish, and it can grow more fish, larger fish. But if things get too far to one side, then it kind of, you know, starts messing with the way the system works.
So I was thinking also about the shade, right? So if there's reduced shade and it's going to take a little while for the willows to grow tall enough, I would imagine, right, to cast enough shade to be what the historic levels were. I don't know. So I've been doing a lot with STEM, like science, technology, engineering, math, and using creative problem solving to, you know, come up with solutions. And have there been any attempts that you know of, or like, I don't know if this is a thing in this area, to have like artificial canopies in the interim, or is it just kind of like a waiting game until the trees can get planted and grow back up?
Honestly, I think with the scope of the fire area, that it would just be prohibitive cost-wise to even try to do something like that. There's just so many streams that lost their riparian shade that, you know, you need a couple million dollars of grant money and, you know, a huge workforce to do that. And so we pretty much basically we're going to have to take that hit, that stream temperature hit, for the next few years, you know, until those willows can grow up. One of the things is that in these floodplains, it's this huge area. And what you are seeing in the stream is a pretty small percentage of the actual water that's stored in the watershed. And so there's a whole bunch of water that's stored in that cobble and gravel substrate that's in the floodplain areas. And so that water moves back and forth through that floodplain and into the channel. And we call that, here's your vocabulary word for the week, and that's hyperreic flow. So that's flow that flows underneath the substrate and kind of pops out in springs and things like that in the creek. And what happens is, as that water leaves the stream and enters the floodplain into those cobbles, it actually cools and then it pops back out as cooler water. And so one of the benefits of doing this restoration work is we're going to increase that connection with the floodplain and that hyperreic flow. And so I'm hoping that by doing some of those restoration work, we're going to be able to mitigate some of those stream temperature increases by increasing that hyperreic flow.
Awesome. Yeah, it sounds like, you know, utilizing what nature has been doing and just making sure that nature can do it, right?
Correct. And that's kind of where I've come to in my career, is kind of full circle to, let's just mimic what nature would have done as much as we possibly can. And that tends to work out the best, rather than trying to control nature and manipulate it and bring this like really heavily engineered approach to it. You know, it's look at what you find in these, you know, kind of maybe pristine natural systems, and then try to mimic that the best you can where you have these kind of more degraded systems. And it usually, that usually works out the best.
I love that. Where can people go to learn more if they're really interested in this subject matter?
Let's see, you know, probably they could just contact me directly. I'm fine with getting phone calls or emails if folks have questions about that. My phone number is 541-464-3316. And my email is jmcenroe@blm.gov. And I'd be happy to answer any questions folks have. I can't say there's really, you know, a website to find out more about the specific restoration work that we're planning up there. But, you know, I have PowerPoint presentations I put together. I've given them to, you know, the Watershed Council or other groups. And so if there is a group out there that wants to find out more about the restoration work and see some photos and maps and design drawings and things like that, I can just get a hold of me and I will give you a talk. So, yeah, I guess one thing I didn't talk about. So Rock Creek, where we're going to do most of the restoration work, that was where kind of the epicenter of the fire, the fish species that are there, I didn't really talk about that. It's got a very diverse assemblage of fish, one of the most diverse of, you know, any of the watersheds in the North Umpqua. And so it has spring Chinook salmon that utilize kind of the main creek. It's got coho salmon and summer and winter steelhead that utilize the tributaries and those side channels I was talking about. And then it's got cutthroat trout, Pacific lamprey, bureau-sensitive species, we call it, a yellow-legged frog. And then we also have beaver in there that, you know, try to get a foothold, but there's too much stream energy, you know. And so we're hoping that beaver provide a lot of great watershed processes and functions. And so we're hoping that by getting some, decreasing that stream energy, we'll get, you know, beavers to establish in the watershed. So.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. We also had a previous interview with someone who was talking all about beavers and kind of some of the benefits that they can have in an ecosystem. So,
cool. Perfect.
Yeah, things are all coming together. Awesome. If people are listening to all of the episodes, they'll just be able to put those puzzle pieces together and have a really great full picture.
Awesome. Perfect.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Ryan. I had a great time talking with you.